seeps out into slacker muscles. Maybe Philemon is feeling it.
Gostag knows nothing about warp drives, he says.
Philemon snorts.
You're blind, Vox. I have already told you, and you do not listen. We are a long way from your protector, and the longer we linger here, the worse it will get.
Vox halts.
Do you really think I am blind, Philemon?
He asks gently.
Do you think I have done nothing, knowing what is whispered? Calm yourself. I have done as you recommended. We are at war again now, just as you counseled, and we will win this one handsomely. Your allies will betray you, Philemon says.
Vox almost punches him.
They have deployed 743 warriors to our 621. They have 34,567 troops drawn from their bonded slave caste and command the allegiance currently of 128 demonic creatures. They have 56 major armor pieces and... I also have done the sums. The warp is thinning over that citadel, says Philemon. Count Quick tells me something big waits on the other side, and it will not be friendly to us. You know these people. You know why they desire a world like this. Just one sacrifice, one big drawing of blood, and they will have all the power they could ever command.
He is becoming exasperated.
This is what they do!
My friend, says Vox,
and means it, for they are friends, after a fashion.
Our task is to take this world and give honor to the faith. That is my only intention. Your concerns are noted, though your intimation that I am ignorant of the dangers is unwelcome. All is as it should be. Now, I wish you to add your blades to the others. I have only one specific command. Otherwise, you may slay where you will.
Philemon looks up at him. Doubt clouds his face. Unlike most of them, Philemon still has the lingering traces of human features and mannerisms, and does not spend his life masked behind a decaying helm face.
Anything, he says.
They will fight hard at the end. I would not wish for one of us to take the credit for a successful outcome. You must detain him, Philemon. Wrap him up in fighting. I know you know how to do it.
Philemon looks at him doubtfully.
Is that not dangerous?
Only for the enemy.
Vox smiles under his rotting mask.
Cledo has orders to find the master of the city. When he does, I must be at his shoulder, ready to claim the kill.
He places his gauntlet on Philemon's shoulder, and feels the mass of boils and pustules blistering under the hard surface.
Try not to worry. All have roles, all have purposes. Even now, the matter unfolds according to the god's grand design. Sooner or later, this will become apparent to all of us, even the lowliest.
Dantine has fought on many worlds before, but not like this. He has gone into battle with a lasgun in his hands and a burning horizon ahead, but not like this. A part of him thought that he might be left behind on the ship, and so he curled up in his cell, alone, hoping to be forgotten.
He knows that it was his soul trail that brought them here. His life on Sabatine as a lieutenant in the Astra Militarum left its trace on the warp, just as all life leaves its trace there. Perhaps his valor even made its mark, his capacity for bravery among squads of loyal men and women. But it is likely that the other thing made a greater impression, the shame of his demotion, betrayal, discovery. The warp, Dantine thinks, seems to absorb the darker sides of human nature more readily than the lighter. It is a sink for the emotions, but drinks more readily of baser instincts.
Nothing he ever did in the past, however, compares to this. He was taken alive on Najan. He was made into a tool for the monsters. And now he has led them here, to the world of his birth, where they will destroy it all. His name is all over it. If any annals are ever written of this sordid episode, somewhere, in some footnote or cross-reference, it will be said that Captain Dantin, the weak, the traitorous, was the cause of it all. It matters not that he intended none of it. It matters not that he had no choice. Choice, intent, weakness. These are things to be despised, says the Inquisition. Only outcomes matter. Only orders followed or objectives achieved. They came for him near the end of the muster. Vaux must have sent them, he thinks. Two of his unbroken, foul-smelling, with seeping eye-lenses and fungus-brown armour. He could not resist, of course, and was dragged from his cot and thrown into a shuttle bay with hundreds of other unchanged. Somehow he found himself with a rusty lasgun in his hands, an ancient mark, more like a flintlock than a serious weapon, its power pack already half-depleted and leaking acid. On the descent, he reflected on the use of the word unchanged for those human slaves the Death Guard employ. It is a strange name, for they have all been changed in many ways. Some of that is physical. They carry sores and boils and infections beyond count. Most are dying of something or other, although few seem to mind that, or even notice it. Some of their slavery, then, must be mental, too. They cough up blood, and then grin. They wheeze and gasp and clutch at their throats, but no word of complaint passes their scabrous lips. Some are little more than imbeciles, the ones that grin all the time and seem like flesh puppets, but others retain at least some faculties. These are the ones that man the crew stations, that aim the ship's great guns, that pilot the shuttles and refuel the landers. They are mad by Imperial standards, but not insensible. Then again, as Vaux told him, what is sane about anything in this galaxy? What is the greater madness? To be sick and happy, or healthy and desperate? Such blasphemy, he thinks. How swiftly I have fallen. After making planetfall, he finds himself jostled towards the front line along with the others. There are no orders, no ranks, just a stumbling headlong race. He struggles to breathe, to keep his feet. His chest hurts. His hands ache. He barely recognizes the world he once served on. It smells foul, corrupted. The ground is hot from the massed orbital lasers. It is pitch dark, and the flashes of the explosions do little other than disorientate him. So he just stumbles with the rest of them. Only slowly, after a long march, does he get some sense of where he is. Great lasbeams smash through the press around him, immolating those in their path. Shells land in the crowds, blowing the invaders into tatters of flying flesh scraps, and no one stops moving. He sees the pale lenses of his tormentors in the gloom, but they are far away, herding them like cattle. In the distance somehow, over the crash and boom of ordnance, he can hear agonized cries and chanting in harsh tongues. Then he sees walls above him, and realizes how far he has come. The battlements are already ruined, their summits lying in a sawtooth slump of rubble. Bodies are piled up, absurd amounts of bodies, and they create a haphazard ramp up to the breach. Lasbeams fly around him, making the air fizz, yet none touch him. The toothless wretch on his left side is hit by an explosive bolt and flies backwards into the dark. Another takes his place, and they keep climbing. He glimpses the great dark hulls of tanks crunching across fields of corpses, lights flaring, engines revving. Everything is blurred. Everything is moving. He is not afraid. He feels cold, always cold, and guesses that is because Vaux is far away. He reaches a crown of buried corpses and smouldering wreckage, and spies the enemy for the first time. They are crouched in their positions on the inner rampart edge, holding the line, firing methodically and well. In the dark, he recognizes the colors he used to wear, gray and blue, and sees the charred remains of battle standards snapping crazily in the crosswinds. Somehow, he has made it to the front line. The other bodies move jerkily, caught in a freeze frame. The unbroken, masked by the hordes of stumblers, are fighting their way inside the citadel, grinding towards the interior where the towers rise and the searchlights whirl. Mobile armor comes with them, smashing through half-demolished walls, barrels swiveling. Overhead, gunships hover on heat haze that makes the air shake, emptying magazines into far-off targets. He has not yet fired his weapon. He feels like a spare part, a piece of driftwood thrown up on a dark tide. The air fills with more lasfire, vivid and searing, and it makes his eyes water. He stumbles, falling to his knees on a pile of powderized stonework. Before he knows it, he's falling, tumbling down the far side of a long heap. When he regains his feet, he has slipped far, down into the citadel's grounds, and can see the enemy on either side of him, much closer now. From somewhere, a desperate hope suddenly kindles. He holds his gun up, holds his other hand up, and staggers towards the nearest barricade.
"Do not fire!" he croaks. "I can fight with you!"
This is the only way out. One last time, fighting with those he has doomed. If he kills one of the monsters this way, just one of them, that would be something. He gets closer and can see the glint of grey helms over the heaps of rubble.
"Let me!"
he shouts. The first shot hits him in the shoulder, throwing him back. The beam slices straight through, punching the mesh of his uniform and fizzling out the other side. He reels and drops to one knee. Then another one hits him, slapping into his chest and hurling him onto his back. It doesn't hurt. It is just cold. He feels a trickle of blood in both wounds, but it is black and stinking. He rolls over, coating himself in mud. Both those wounds should have been fatal, but he is still breathing. He tries to lift himself, and his arm gives out. He collapses back to earth, and his face hovers for a moment over an oily puddle. There is a flash in the skies, some starburst of munitions going off, and for a fraction of a second he catches his reflection in the water. No wonder they fired. He barely looks human. His eyes are bulging, his cheeks hollow. His old uniform is just rags now, exposing a horrifying body, jutting ribs, swathes of bile-greased fat. He has no teeth. When did he lose those? Just an empty mouth that runs with bloody saliva. He has no hair, and the skin on his scalp is flaking off, uncovering the skull beneath. He hangs there for a moment, over the water, staring. If he still had a heart, it would be hammering. His fists clench, dragging through the bloody gravel. He wants to scream, but he has already done so much of that. "This is how I look to them." And he finds then that he cannot even remember what he looked like before. He gets up. He is panting, but not from exertion. He is still cold, but there is something else inside him now. He is confused. He might be angry. He swings round, back towards the barricades. From behind him, he can hear others sliding and stumbling down the long slope. His people.
His people.
He opens fire. The lasgun whines, sending the first shot into the night. Then he fires again and starts to walk. Soon he is joined by the others, and they advance in something like formation. The fires roar overhead. Smoke tumbles across the cityscape, and it coils around his boots. He will be at the barricade soon. He will be unstoppable when he gets there. He feels a spark of pleasure in that. He guesses he ought not to, but can no longer remember why. He fires, and fires again. Dantine has fought on many worlds before, but not like this. It is better this way, though, he thinks. It is something he could learn to like. The charges blow, demolishing the entire tunnel wall ahead of them. Garstag is running before the last of them ignites, his huge body hurtling into the flying debris. For the most part, Garstag moves slowly, but when he has to, when the old rages are stoked again, he can still generate frightening momentum. His chainsword swings, batting aside falling rock, and he barges through the rest of it, shouldering aside tottering pillars and wheeling around to find a target. The rest of the Cardane come behind him, cutting and blasting. Slurts, unbroken, are still working the turbo hammers, enlarging the breach and securing its edges against collapse. It already stinks in here, the spore they brought with them caking the fire-heated stonework, the fetid air spilling up into sterile chambers. Garstag powers upwards, smashing aside the damaged remains of a doorway and crashing into a vaulted hall beyond. They are waiting. Alarms sound, tinny and shrill, and whirling warning lumens make everything bloody. The last fire is not as it was on Najan. It is precise, directed, massed on single points. Garstag runs right into it, his body taking the hits. His battle brothers are close on his heels, and they wade into the fight, building up the swing of their scythes. Garstag says nothing. He pants, he grunts, he works the gunning blades, but no words pass his lips. He can hear the enemy shouting to one another, orders, warnings, even that stale old injunction, "For the Emperor." It seems to help them. Garstag has never uttered a war cry, not even when he fought in the Barbaran Legion, and these divisions had not yet emerged. Like all his legion, he enters combat in silence, letting his work speak for him. To invoke another, even the Primarch, would be to admit weakness, a lack of self-sufficiency, to open the suspicion that there is luck or favour involved in these things. He shrugs off more hits and lumbers towards the first barricade. They have barred the width of this chamber halfway along its length, dozens of them, all armoured, holding their ground and keeping discipline. He finds himself admiring that, even as he crunches through the first barrier and starts his chainblade whirling again. Behind him, he can hear more invaders pouring up through the breach, their armour steaming from the last dregs of Slurt's broth. Bolt shells crack out, spinning into battle plate and exploding, throwing bodies aside. The first tang of blood enters the melange of aromas, and it spikes Garstag's battle mood further. It takes him a moment to realize that not all the bolt shells are coming from the Unbroken. The chamber is dark, already filling with smoke, and he almost misses the faint flash of white and blue power armor. They are high up, the corpse spawn, in a gallery level that runs around the rim of this chamber, and they are breaking out of cover now, hemming them in and pinning them down. Garstag sees Arterion take a flurry of hits, stumbling over them, his breastplate cracking. By the god! That might even end him. Garstag presses on, taking a detonation on his right pauldron. He slaughters freely, working his way down the barricade. Once at the far side, back under some cover, he can turn his attention to the Space Marines.
"Putrefier!"
he barks over the comm.
"Slurt! Where are you?"
His visual field is already cluttered, spiraling with locator runes. More of the enemy are racing into the chamber's far end, trying to staunch this wound, and the volume of lasfire rakes upward. More of this, and even he will take too much damage.
"Just do what you are doing, Cardane Master!"
Slurt's voice comes back, sounding like it's a long way off.
"I have my own errands to run!"
Garstag finally pulls up the putrefier's locator amid all the junk and sees that Slurt is nowhere near. He's heading deeper, into places where no true defenders will be, only huddled, terrified fodder fit for nothing but the sustenance vats.
"Slurt!"
he roars.
"This is no time to—"
But he never finishes. Three tactical marines of a white consul squad have vaulted down from the gallery, and already they are mobbing Branad. A heavy weapons team drags something multi-barreled in through the far chamber doorway. They are fighting furiously, these defenders, and the attack on the barricades falters. Even the carapace-armored defenders are rallying, making up in numbers and coordination for what they lack in individual power. Garstag snarls and guns his chainsword up a notch. Slurt can do what he wants.
"The rot stops here!"
he voxes to his counterparts, irritated, striding with greater purpose now.
"Tear them apart!"
Chapter 18. Finally, there is fighting again. True fighting.
fighting that hurts, fighting that is a test. Dragon feels his muscles burning. His killing hand is dripping with blood and power armor coolant. His bolt pistol is almost out of ammunition, his armor dented and charred. A white consul comes for him, sprinting down the long gallery. They are all within the citadel now, just part of the contagion that spreads through it. Word-bearers run rampant, carried by their momentum of terror and atrocity. Tanks roll down the narrow streets and up steep ramps, bolstered by whole squads of unbroken. Flames have broken out all over, fast-kindled slicks of oil, and the smoke gets everywhere, making the atmosphere bitter and choking. Dragon sees one of the unbroken blasted apart, riddled with hits from at least two bolters. He sees a gang of Sabbatine Praetorians slaughtered by a single word-bearer carrying a bronze axe. The slaughter is free-flowing now. They are in among the enemy, in their halls and their corridors, their dungeons and their command towers. The white consul crashes into contact, and the two of them trade crushing blows. Dragon has to work hard to move his claw, to block a swipe from a power sword, to push back, to go for the jugular. These adversaries are fast, precise, working in interlocking squads that back one another up and press forward in tandem. Already Dragon can see more locator signals approaching, racing into battle. He cries out as he punches back with the claw, hurling the white consul into an already teetering column. He swivels, trying to draw a bead with the pistol, but his adversary is not yet done. He lunges back into contact, thrusting his power sword two-handed. Dragon feels the blade bite, carving down under the layers and layers of filth and sediment and rotting ceramite. He pulls away, swinging forcefully and nearly yanking the sword out with him. His claw whistles hard and fast, punching into the white consul's midriff and driving through the cabling. Impaled, the space marine still fights, scrabbling for a bolt pistol to fire at point-blank range. He nearly makes it. Dragon jerks his killing talons suddenly upward, lifting his adversary from his feet and crushing his lungs. Then he fires his own pistol straight into the space marine's gorget, blowing his throat out with a single shot. After that, he's moving again, shaking the corpse loose and running, making use of the power and speed that he still possesses, even as his battle brothers sway and stride behind him. The gallery has its roof blown off at the far end, collapsed after being hit by a Thunderhawk's battle cannon, and smog is piling in from the maelstrom outside. Dragon can just make out the burning profile of towers beyond, still with the flickering trails of void shields, but now swarmed by gunships. The invaders are getting close to the citadel's inner layers now, fighting steadily up every artery and causeway. The going is stone hard, the defense ferocious and committed. How could it not be? There is nowhere for these people to go. Another space marine races to engage him, haloed in a wave of solid round fire from dug-in Praetorians. Dragon fires the last of his bolt shells, missing narrowly. He can admire the commitment here, even the skill. But in truth, these enemies are just symbols for him, obstacles to be overcome, like whetstones to sharpen his own capability. The two of them slam together, blade against claw, and their limbs blur. He absorbs another stab and staggers back. His enemy goes after him, fainting before thrusting. But Dragon is bigger and stronger, his body flooded with the gifts of the god. He slices in return, a vicious transverse whip that scores across his enemy's breastplate and carves up the armor. Phages catch where his poisoned talons dig deep, and the blood is thicker than it should be. But still the space marine fights on, driving his blade into Dragon's stomach, once, twice, severing muscles wetly. Dragon cries out, furious now. He headbutts the space marine, and their helms crack together. He butts again, then swings a leaden punch, catching him full on his cracked faceplate. A lens is shattered. More blood sprays. For a moment, he thinks he's done enough, but the space marine stabs with the sword tip again, going for his throat. Dragon yanks away from danger, and the killing edge shoots a finger's width past his chin. He punches a final time, putting all his weight and fury behind it. A pile-driver of a strike that caves in the ceramite and digs down into flesh beyond. He feels the skull crumple, the burst of hot fluid, and knows this is, at last, enough. As he rises, searching for another kill, he is panting, covered in sweat, his twin hearts booming. The wall ahead of him collapses, blown apart by the impact of something enormous. He hears the drum and boom of engines, and a vox-distorted roar. Then the dreadnought emerges from the dust and flying debris, striding out in an aegis of battle cries. Tragen can just make out shouts of, "Jeremiah's!" before an assault cannon opens up. He flings himself to the floor as the world dissolves into a thunder of destruction. Locator runes blink out across his swaying visual feed, and he knows that his brothers are dying.
"Shit!" he curses,
crawling over the corpse of the space marine he has just killed, reaching out for his bolter. The dreadnought sways closer, treading heavily through a crumpled landscape of tangled steel and rockcrete. White consoles are advancing behind it, using it for cover, and Dragon sees two word-bearers caught up in the barrage and shredded. He runs a quick mental tally, the surviving unbroken in the gallery versus the enemy, and realizes they cannot win this.
"Shit!"
he says again, grabbing the bolter and preparing to leap to his feet. He never makes it. From behind him, from the stairwell that they have just gained with their own tally of bloodshed, something even bigger emerges. Freed from his prison on Solace, Naum seems ludicrously big, as if he is uncurled and stretched out, and relaxed, held in lungs and stomachs. He staggers into the ruined gallery, his huge shoulders ploughing through the vaulted roof and showering his path with clumps of plaster. Just like the rest of the Unbroken, he is hardly raging. His mouth gapes, and his tiny eyes amid all that plate and flesh and dust are merely blinking, as if startled by the light. He is covered in blood, his claws dripping with it, and a battered white console is still clutched in one fist, dragged like a child drags a half-forgotten doll. The dreadnought lets loose on him, booming battle cries and sending streams of shells smacking into the Leviathan's leathery hide. The space marines follow up, generating their own chorus of bolter fire. Naum never even cries out. The projectiles thud into him, stripping and tearing, rocking the hellbrute back on his immense, squat legs. He just keeps on going, lowering his shoulders against the withering barrage, throwing the bedraggled corpse aside and reaching out for the origin of this fresh pain. Dragon watches his tiny grey face crumple into a kind of confused agony before he strides past, closing on the dreadnought. Other survivors, both Unbroken and Wordbearer, scramble up from their prone positions and join the assault. This engagement is accelerating fast. The terrain around them is taking a hammering from the flying shells, and another column blows apart in a hail of stone flecks. Dragon gets to his feet, taking aim, ignoring the blood running down his chest. Just as he does, he gets a priority comburst from Philemon.
"Gallowsman, withdraw to my position." "Are you mad?"
Dragon growls, opening fire. He keeps low, trying to draw a bead on that accursed dreadnought before Naum obscures his line of sight entirely.
"We're closing on the heart of it." "That is the issue. Look around you. How many word-bearers in your attack?"
Hardly any. The brunt of this is being borne by the Unbroken, and they are paying a heavy price. Even as he watches, another plague marine is smashed to the ground, his armor torn open by the blistering onslaught of the assault cannon. Naum swaggers into close range, swinging his enormous fists, and finally croaking out something like anger.
"Vorx has let this slip," Philemon goes on. "You know it, brother. We're being used. He won't move against them until it's too late."
Dragon hesitates, crouching down again. The crescendo of bolter shells is driving all other sounds out, and another wall is teetering on the edge of destruction. He sees a white console go down under heavy fire, and another Unbroken blasted into lumps of gristle. The two giants are close to wrestling range now, and they are tearing the masonry up around them.
"They're crawling through the tunnels, rounding up the mortals.
You understand what they intend. They let us take this place for them, but it's just an altar. He doesn't see it. Gallowsman, pull back here. Someone needs to act.
Dragan curses. His internal battle maps are jumpy and out of kilter, but he does see some patterns there. Word-bearer units ignoring the main clusters of defense, heading into the hab zones.
Damn him! Vaux was always a credulous fool. This was on the cards from the start.
Where are you?
Dragan voxes, pulling back, firing all the while. Naum is hammering at the dreadnought now, huge, two-fisted blows.
Three levels down. Bring what you can. The zealots are the enemy.
Dragan looks up a final time. The fight between the two leviathans is already apocalyptic, and Naum has taken some heavy damage. He would like to watch this, but does not fool himself that there is anything he can do to alter the outcome. A sick feeling washes over him. He has been too keen to get to the action, to exercise that prowess so long kept under wraps. They have all been too keen.
Understood,
he voxes, and begins to move. He can summon many more. He can pull them out and muster at Philemon's position. This is working against Vaux. This is seizing the chance. Despite everything, his long resentment, the knowledge of his destiny, his overbearing confidence, there is still a step to be taken. Perhaps this is the last vestige of his old self, that iron discipline, struggling to shuffle out of contention. When the moment comes, you have to take it. He looks over at Naum, who is lost in his combat now. The blows being exchanged by those two are immortal. Almost regretfully, he opens the comm to the Unbroken under his direct command.
Pull back!
He voxes. He withdraws to the stairwell, firing all the time.
Regroup at coordinates to follow. We have new targets. Repeat, we have new targets.
Slurt likes being underground. Being blind in these places is no handicap at all, and the sensation of cold, old walls pressing in tight is one he is used to. He detects bodies, thousands of them, most very close. They have packed them in, the Imperials, hoarding them like gold in the dungeons of this ancient place. Perhaps they thought they would be safe in here. He has some sympathy for that. A Chapter Fortress monastery would, in ordinary times, be among the very safest places in the galaxy. But as Vaux has reminded them on many occasions, these are hardly ordinary times. The White Consuls have been unlucky. They were cut off, left high and dry. Their strength bled from them in a war on the edge of real space. They have done, in this situation, what 9,000 years of constant doctrine has told them to do. Get behind the walls and gather what strength remains. But these things no longer hold true when a demon can spew forth from the air at the click of fingers. The masters of this world, so close to the epicenter of Abaddon's rift, were already partly overrun before Solas got here, and this is just the final act. For all the talk of tests and danger, Vaux must have known there was little risk here. The true danger comes from elsewhere. That is the great lesson of history, something the Death Guard have always appreciated. The real enemy is seldom the one you can see, in front of you with sword in hand, but the one you can't, in the shadows, or in the past, or within yourself, coiled ready for the moment of ripening, when all plans are suddenly undone. Slurt is not alone. He makes his pilgrimage down the tunnels with his guards, the Unbroken of his Carder, limping through the dark in their phosphor-pale battleplate. He has his servitors and his slaves, hauling the contraptions he has brought down so reverently from Solas. They are huge, those machines, marked with the sign of the god, and dragged on corroding segmented tracks. They hiss and they gout, powered by that familiar fusion of the mechanical and the divine, studded with grapple-mounted vials that swill dark fluids. Slurt would not like to lose these things. He has poured much effort into them, working the bellows, refining the pumps. They are fragile, for all their apparent sturdiness. A single well-aimed bolt shell would puncture the bladders and flood the tunnels. And thus he goes deep, keeping the Unbroken ahead and behind, scurrying through the narrow ways of the Citadel's forgotten foundations. His gifted eyes are busy throughout. They peer up, they peer out, focusing and blinking under the skin. He can see constellations of souls above, rammed tight, like glowing mats of coral under a night-black ocean. The guard will be light on these places, for the Castellans are more than busy elsewhere. That is what he must hope in any case. Time is also short. For so long they have had all the time they could ever want, in the eye and out of it, and yet now it is racing, aging them, wearing at them. Perhaps this is a blip, an aberration, and the long war will return to its silted-up course. He does not know yet which option he would prefer. He blinks. He senses the sicknesses, the fears, the mortal pungency of anticipation. Slurt would have liked to have seen the Primarch, to have examined him with his many perceptive eyes. He would have liked to have entered the manse and witnessed just for a moment what glorious contagions have been created in that superlative body. For this reason, along with many others, he still cleaves to Vorx's path, the one that will take them back to Mortarion's side. All know that he is back, but few have seen him yet. To fight alongside him, at the head of the Legion, just as in the Age of Wonder, that would be the pinnacle of a life. That would be worth all the toil in the laboratoriums and the toxin banks. They are a long way from that. They are in the heart of the wasteland, locked together with two enemies that wish to kill them. The numbers do not look good. The augurs do not look good. Something must be done to swing the scales back in their favor. And so he is condemned to leave the real slaying to Garstak and pursue this grubbing course at the root of the world. Slurt presses on, goading the slave gangs into greater speed. He hears the whispered reports of the Unbroken as they stagger through the dripping vaults, and lets his many eyes do the rest. When his ramshackle cavalcade finally breaks out, bursting upwards and outwards of the long and winding well shafts, it is met by screams and panic. Slurt smiles at this, clambering arduously over an eroded stone lip, and limps out towards them. These are mortal humans, hundreds strong, locked in a chamber they must have thought entirely secure, and here are monsters now clawing their way up from the floor itself. How nightmarish for them! How like every bad dream they have ever had!
"Calm down,"
he says, amused by the reaction. This is merely the first of many chambers he has to process. Already the devices are being hauled up, lifted by strong, calloused hands.
"Believe me, this is for the best."
They are trying to get away, but they cannot get out. They are like rats in a trap. Slurt looks out at them, and his many eyes blink. He sees the flow of their overlapping bloodstreams, like the tracery of branches against a winter sky. Nothing he tells them is a lie. Even down here they can hear the nearing booms of combat, the approach of those who have no concern at all for their welfare. And so all this really is for the best. They are clawing at one another now, trying to force the doors open.
"Begin,"
Slurt tells his slaves, and the machines are dragged into position.
"Quick as you can."
It doesn't take long. He smells it first, then feels the chill as the air sighs out of the chamber. Though he cannot see it, he knows what is happening. The first blooms will be rising now, followed by the larvae that have been so carefully harvested. It must be quite, quite beautiful.
"Try to relax,"
Slurt says to them all, remembering how it was in the void so long ago, before all these things were known of, and how much better it has become since then.
"Silence will make this a great deal easier."
Chapter 19 Clado is hunting. This is something he enjoys, being cut loose, away from the slow-moving mass of the warband's forces, and out, almost on his own. He takes only 6 of the Unbroken with him, ones less weighed down with gifts and lighter on their hooves. Together, they fight their way around the margins, ignoring the set-piece actions where the tanks thunder, worming their way higher, narrower, further. Clado has some art here. He is not just a flenser of muscle and an unpicker of veins. He can create mists that confuse, generate fogs that blind. This is not proper sorcery, nor a real and solid grasp of the greater principles of the warp, but a minor and fleeting understanding of optics, of frail psychologies, of the disarming properties of the whisper and the moment of doubt. Such things do not work on the corpse spawn of the Emperor, of course. Space Marines must be fought when they cannot be eluded, and the warriors of this place prove as irritatingly efficient as any Clado has ever encountered. His squad of 7 is now down to 4, and they have only managed to kill 1 of the enemy in return. Were it not for the intervention of warriors of the Weeping Veil during one episode on an exposed transit span, they might have all been killed. They slipped off after that, leaving the zealots to fight on. A shameful action, it might be thought, and one at odds with the philosophies of the old legion. Clado is not, he knows, a very fine example of Mortarian's gene breed. He is too individual, too wedded to moral shadows. He has no faith, not really, just an appreciation for what his station and learning allow him to do. Vaux seems to understand this, and so the command he has been given here, to rove ahead and locate the master of the fortress, suits all concerned. The invaders are advancing freely now. He can hear the tidal crash of combat echoing down every corridor, swelling up like water against the sluices. This citadel is overrun, strangled from every direction, smothered by the weight of the forces sent against it. Clado still cannot quite believe that there are so few corpse-spawn left here, and can only guess that the apocalypse must have overtaken them. He pauses, kneeling and resting his bolt pistol on the floor in front of him. His 3 companions halt in the gloom, respiring softly through their battered and pocked vox grills. Clado sniffs. The air is pungent, not just with fear and spilled blood, but with something else. Something familiar. Something delightful. Gene seed. Vials and vials of it, ranked in vaults, kept at the optimum temperature, secured behind glittering stasis fields. He should have known they were getting close. This is one of the central hubs, a grand octagonal tower that the enemy fought hard to retain. It must be killing them to know that it will fall in its entirety soon. There is vicious fighting all across the lower layers now, the confusion of it allowing Clado and his quiet band to slither ahead of the game. Clado finds himself salivating. He creeps forward, scanning ahead. Just around a sharp corner, there is an open hallway, scorched and raked with bullet holes, littered with bodies piled high. Halfway down that hall, set in the right-hand wall, there is an opening, a pair of bolter-blown doors. Light spills from the jagged edges, antiseptic bright amid all the murk. He can see the faint, very rapid strobe flicker of lumens. He can smell the chemicals more strongly. They smell the same wherever you find them, these caches. They are prescribed like that, by Mars, and they never vary. Clado amuses himself by thinking that in all of these strong points, even on Chogoris, even on Fenris, there will be a chamber just like this, a little sliver of the tech priest's domains, lodged in every monastery of every kind. At heart, the Imperials understand just what Clado understands, that the body is just another machine to be tinkered with and extended and stretched out. They have not yet grasped the opposite truth, most of them, that machines are really just like bodies too, and that it is actually very simple to blur the line the other way, should you have the inclination to do so. For a moment, he thinks the way to the vault is open. He creeps forward again, coming up from his crouch, and the scent of all those lined-up vials makes his stomach grumble.
Oh, such joys to be had with the contents of those glass cylinders! Oh, such wonders to be performed!
Then he freezes. At the far end of the hallway, something is moving, heedless of stealth, rushing back from another fight. In an instant, Plato knows he has found what he has been hunting. This one is greater than the rest, with a crested helm and grime-spattered armor. He carries a thunder hammer, though the energy field has been extinguished somehow. It is caked with burned black blood. Two others come with him, retainers by their look. They are also battle-ravaged, covered in the visible signs of hard combat, and they carry notched blades. All three stride through the evidence of destruction, hurrying to make the shattered gateway, to shore up this last defense for just a little longer. Plato opens the secure channel to Vaux. He uses the device Vaux himself gave him, the one that cuts through the hiss and muffle, and speaks directly.
"Target located. We'll engage, but you may need to be swift. There are treats here, and I am eager to gather them."
Then he is charging, his warriors coming with him. The white consuls are moving, too, a little faster, their movements a little more motivated by anger, by that edge of desperation that comes before destruction. By the time the first blow comes in, Plato is almost giggling.
"This is going to be horrible," he thinks,
just as always. Vaux watches it all unfold. Thus far, he has not lifted his scythe in anger. He watches the citadel burn, and it gives him no pleasure. He came in on the Thunderhawk Thar. He saw from high altitude the rings of fire around the entire place, which he knows from history is called Vigilia Carceris. He knows that it has been the seat of power in this subsector for the duration of the Long War, and that it has been an exemplary model of the Imperial governing pattern. There is much to admire in that pattern, for all that Vaux thinks it misguided. The measure of an enemy is not whether you agree with them, for there are a thousand species of disagreement, but whether they live out their philosophy with integrity. That is why he despises the Thousand Sons, for they lie to themselves about what they do and who they are. But he has never sneered at another soul, ally or enemy, who faced the truth of the universe as they understood it, and did not shrink from the consequences. The white consuls, to the best of his knowledge, were of the latter breed. They made their home on the cliff edge, peering like falcons into the turning gyre below. More than most chapters of the Imperium, they knew the balance of madness that motivates the warp. They could have stationed themselves somewhere more remote, even close to the petty empire of their dead Primarch, and thus lived a few centuries longer. That they didn't, and chose this eternal vigilance poised atop the seeds of their doom, is something to admire. Vaux watches the noose slip tight. He processes the streams of lumen blotch data brought to him from a thousand scattered biomech flies. He senses the harmonics of struggle and defiance. He listens to 100 Vaux streams at once, filtering them with his old subtle mind. A painting emerges, a piece of gaudy art, endlessly changing, fixed around clustered points of incoming statistics. He watches the apostles of the Weeping Veil as they fight, and cannot suppress a mite of distaste. It is an effective strategy, this terror-causing, this pain-worship, and yet it leaves him cold. He knows why they do it, as Philemon told him, assuming he didn't already know. The warp is thinning fast over the citadel, and the presences on the other side are already swimming closer. The more the apostles generate anguish, the quicker they will achieve their goal. Just as Slurt predicted, they are already diverting forces to the catacombs, sacrificing a fraction of speed in order to reap a harvest of another kind. He watches the Lords of Silence take the brunt of the main assault in the higher towers. He observes Dragon leading the most effective inroads, making the best use of Naum he has ever seen. The gallowsman has so many gifts, he thinks, so much raw talent. He watches the rings of defences crumble and implode one by one, each level fought over bitterly. He sees clouds of pestilence rise from the burning earth, worming their way under the environment masks of the enemy soldiers. He sees the consuls rally, again and again, clinging to every strong point with that damnable determination.
Even when they are encircled by the choking fires of their own burnt dead, cut off, beaten back, they come at the invaders still. They empty their bolters and exhaust the power units on their lasguns, then reach for blades. Their disruptors blow, their steel is notched, and then they clench their fists. Such power of belief, thinks Vorks, such blind, impressive, ill-directed belief. Soon he can take the Thunderhawk in closer to the heart of it, dipping between spires that all glow from inner burning. The atmosphere is a poison now, a slough of physoline and promethium, thick as the sullen seas that seethe beyond the cliff edge. Fuel dumps must have been hit somewhere, sending churning walls of red-black filth rolling through every chink of open space, staining the stone to darkness, making the entire citadel a bitter, guttering candle. Carcasses are lumped in open courtyards, some already bursting with the tiny phage creatures that will soon spill across the entire planet. Ahead of him, embedded in ruined rock-creek battlements, he sees the skeleton of a gunship, its bones carbon dark and still smoking thickly. In the distant street levels below, tanks are toppled like children's toys, their tracks twisted into ribbons. A few war standards still flutter weakly from balconies, torn and threadbare. The Aquilas, those most enduring symbols of the Corpse Emperor, have been smashed and ground underfoot. Vorks draws closer to the great ribbed towers with their gothic eaves and domed pinnacles. He sees the pockets of remaining resistance, islands now in this storm of ruin. And it is only then, buoyed on the hot currents of the city pyre, drifting amid the embers of a crumbling empire, that he hears from Clado at last. Clado. Cunning Clado. Sent ahead to isolate the greatest of the warriors within this collapsing fortress, the one soul destined to die at Vorks's own hand. Vorks even knows his name. Saimar Zidius, who has already served for centuries, and will die as he has lived, unyielding, spitting defiance, carrying himself with that maddening, error-strewn dignity. The Tha is turned towards the signal. Vorks does not hurry. Clado will be fighting by now, set against a foe he has no chance of besting. The Thunderhawk booms its way under the parapets of the inner citadel, angling to avoid its smoke-streamed walls. The gunship reaches a high balustrade scattered with blown brickwork and hovers on its smoggy turbines. Vorks stirs himself, reaches for exact, and departs the gunship, leaping heavily from the juddering platform. His 12 bodyguards come with him, all in Tartarus plate, carrying cleavers, mauls, and morning stars, all dragging themselves through their own mires of entrail-spilling gifts. Clado voxes again.
Getting difficult. Haste appreciated.
The surgeon's voice is strained. Vorks does not hurry. Instead, he watches. The device he gave Clado is not, as the surgeon imagines, a simple combead. It has the eyeball of a demon locked within its lead heart, plucked from the beautiful face of a keeper of secrets and slave to Vorks's patient will. When the siege master closes his eyes, he sees the world through Clado's position, his vantage swinging from the amulet set about Clado's neck. Thus, Vorks has the leisure to witness Zidius's last great kill. Even as Vorks sends his bodyguards off to seal the chambers beyond and prevent any interruptions, he sees the White Consul's chaptermaster hurl the thunderhammer into Clado's midriff, smashing the ceramite and twisting the shards deep into puckered skin. He sees the lesser warriors grapple around the two titans, neutralizing one another and succumbing to their own necessary deaths. In truth, though, Zidius is the only one there who matters. He is as magnificent as Vorks hoped he would be, and he far outclasses Clado. The mismatch is almost embarrassing. Zidius bludgeons Clado, cracking him back a pace. Then again, with two reverse sweeps of the hammer. Clado tries to fire at him, close range, and has his gun hand mangled for his trouble. Zidius is enraged, of course, calling out to his emperor with every strike. The fury is incandescent and generates its own strange, intangible aura of kinetic power. Clado's cynicism has no purchase on this, and so he is smashed back again, slamming into the wall at his back, his corroded power pack dented amid plumes of kicked-out dust. Still, Vorx does not hurry. He enters the antechambers leading to the gene vaults and treads over still warm bodies, white consuls and death guard, space marines and unbroken. Now he is close enough to hear the real echoing cracks and slams of combat, though there are still a few doorways to traverse. The others in that place are soon dead, all but the two who concern him. Zidius loses his companions, but so does Clado. The chapter master has proved enough for all of them. Now he is closing on the retreating surgeon with the light of retribution in his blood-stained helm lenses.
"Where are you?"
Clado pants, working hard just to stay alive. Vorx maintains his steady pace. He sees Zidius smash Clado's helm open, exposing that narrow, eroded face. He sees Zidius land a heavy punch, shattering Clado's shoulder, then follow with a one-handed swing of the thunderhammer that lifts Clado up and hurls him across the blood-pooled floor. Vorx crosses the last threshold just in time to see, with his real eyes, Zidius grab Clado by the neck guard and haul his limp body back up, only to slam it down again. The chapter master raises a boot and stamps imperiously on Clado's exposed face, crunching bone.
"Enough!"
says Vorx, steadying himself and brandishing exact. Zidius whirls to face the newcomer. The chamber floor around him is clustered with corpses, like some lost battlefield on some lost barbarian world. The few remaining lumens gutter and swing, fizzing with sparks. The destroyed doorway to the gene seed vaults lies open still, and the chapter master stands before it. Clado, what remains of him, twitches weakly. Vorx can see that Zidius is exhausted. He has already killed so many, fighting for hours, standing before the combined power of two legions, and pouring all his defiance out at them. His weapon has been rendered defunct, his armor is pitted and broken, and still he walks, keeping himself erect, maintaining that rolling, menacing gait that is the natural consequence of so much remorseless physical conditioning.
"Go back!"
Zidius threatens Vorx, raising the thunderhammer. His voice is cracking a little, but still strong.
"Go back to the hell you came from!"
That would not be difficult. The entire galaxy is now turning into that very same hell, in these regions at least.
"Know this,"
Vorx says in his archaic Gothic, trying his best to be readily understandable.
"Your chapter's gene seed will be destroyed by my hand. None will be taken. None will be defiled."
By now, Zidius is running. He throws himself, body and soul, into the first strike. His thunderhammer smacks hard into exact, and the blow is shuddering, one that even Vorx has to work hard to brace against.
"Traitor!"
Zidius hisses, his voice distorted by the distilled venom of the betrayed.
"The bodies of your warriors will not be mutilated,"
Vorx continues quietly, throwing Zidius off and ramming the scythe's heel at him.
"Those taken alive will have honorable deaths."
Zidius is fast. He is powerful, intelligent, and precise. Another strike cracks exact away, and the chapter master powers into the opened gap, landing a gauntleted punch on Vorx's breastplate.
"The throne endures!"
Zidius roars.
"Terror endures!"
Vorx has to battle harder now. Containing this inferno is difficult.
"The names of the slain will be recorded," he says, straining to match the heft and velocity of the thunderhammer's strikes. "That is a kind of immortality, a better kind than the one you were promised."
They rock and swing around one another. Vorx is the greater in stature, a swollen creature of the god, and Zidius has to push himself to the limit just to make contact. The chapter master is already wounded from many earlier fights. Vorx can see the infections pulsing their way around his body, but somehow it doesn't slow him.
"The light will come again,"
Zidius thunders. And that, of all that has been claimed or boasted, is a genuine sorrow.
It will never come again. There has not been light, genuine light, for 10,000 years. Vorks should know. He witnessed it, the original blaze of hope being extinguished by the doomed Warmaster at the behest of gods he now serves. So this pain must end. This delusion must end.